The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So, for the beginning of the new year, people often have intentions or aspirations. We call them resolutions, but not so much in the Buddhist world. And sometimes they involve the body. So people want to be more fit or more strong or more healthy or something over the course of the year, something related to their body. And that's fine. It's good to have a healthy body and to pay attention to that. But a lot of these intentions are about controlling the body. And one thing that we learn over the course of our lives is that we don't have as much control as we wish, right? Or maybe not much at all. And so I would suggest that if you're drawn to having intentions around your body, maybe try to have the intention to better understand your body over this year. See if you can learn something valuable from your body that will reduce suffering in your life. The body is an excellent teacher. So the topic for today is the body as a vehicle of practice. And we'll explore various dimensions of that. I've always been drawn to body practice in various ways. So it's actually what got me into meditation originally. And it's never gotten old. Years and years, it just goes deeper and deeper. So there's really a lot that we can learn from our body. Jack Kornfield says, sometimes people think they're going on retreat to have an out-of-body experience, but they're actually going to have an in-body experience. And even if you haven't been on retreat, you've probably discovered this just from sitting practice, right? You don't escape from your body while you're sitting there. In fact, you feel that knee pain all the more. So we have an embodied practice in our tradition, and this is actually how it's supposed to be. The Buddha intended us to use all the means that we have, and that includes our physical body, to awaken. When John Travis was a beginning student in India, his teacher noticed that he was trying to achieve some kind of detachment, bodily detachment, through his practice. And he had a direct teaching method. He actually came over and poked John in the chest and said, you must go through this. So in the same way, we go through our body. We don't leave it behind on the spiritual journey. But what is the body? I mean, do we really know? What is a hand or a spine? And the sense of our body is so different at different times, right? If we're hungry or we're sick or tired, sleeping, meditating, hanging upside down, all these experiences of the body are quite different, right? It's not even correct, maybe, to say this is the body, much less this is my body. It seems like it's a different thing moment to moment. What I love about body practice is that you can approach it at any level. It's kind of like good poetry. So, you can just be right on the surface, or you can take it deeper than that if you want. It's immediately accessible at a top level. Most of us can see and feel our body pretty well. And there are times when it's definitely the most obvious part of our existence. But with some additional effort and focus and intention, the body opens to deeper and deeper layers, and it reveals many truths. In fact, it's said that the body can take you all the way, maybe if you're brave. Actually, the Buddha says it this way. He says, it is just within this fathom-long body, with its perception and intellect, that I declare that there is the cosmos, the origination of the cosmos, the cessation of the cosmos, and the path leading to the cessation of the cosmos. So it's actually all right here. We don't have to find it somewhere else. The body is for sure the physical vehicle of the heavenly messengers, right? So the heavenly messengers that remind us of the importance of practice are aging, illness, and death. And those are going to happen right here to our body. And it's also, in fact, the fourth messenger, which is practice, or having a spiritual discipline that happens through the body also. And as the quote I just read from the Buddha indicates, the body is the gateway to encountering the Four Noble Truths. So in other words, I hope I've convinced you that this is really important. The body is critical, and it can't be left behind, and it also shouldn't spend your days ignoring it. If you can use this opportunity. So there's a sutta that talks a lot about a number of particular body practices that can be done. It's called the Satipatthana Sutta. Some of you may have heard that. I'm going to kind of frame this talk around it a little bit. We won't read the whole thing, it's quite long, but I'm going to kind of pull out the parts that are relevant and relate them to practices that we can do now. So the Satipatthana Sutta is, what that means, it means the four foundations of mindfulness, the foundations of mindfulness. And these are the ways of viewing experience that create an establishment of our practice that's wholesome, that leads it in the right direction. And basically, it's a detailed compilation of practices that can be done that are conducive to liberating insight. And the body is the first foundation of mindfulness, right there at the beginning. And there's a lot of practices, actually, the largest number of practices in this sutta are offered related to the body. In particular, it offers mindfulness of breathing, mindfulness of the postures and actions that the body does, seeing the body as a collection of various body parts, seeing the body as the elements, and then also various ways of contemplating death or the way a dead body decomposes. So those are a little more obscure. But just to get a sense of the potential here, let me read the part of the introduction to this sutta. So the Buddha says, bhikkhus, which means monks, but for us it just means practitioners. This is the direct path for the purification of beings, for the surmounting of sorrow and lamentation, for the disappearance of pain and grief, for the attainment of the true way, for the realization of nibbana, namely the four foundations of mindfulness. So this is not a small thing that he's saying. It's interesting, isn't it, that the disappearance of pain and grief are going to come from looking right at them, which the body houses those. But that's our practice. So this talk is going to talk about the body contemplations that are in the Satipatthana Sutta as they relate to a spectrum of practices that are available to us right here in the modern world. You know, we might think, well, I'm not a monk in ancient India. But there's actually a number of really easy ways that we can do these things right here in our lives. So some are quite simple, and others are go really quite deep and may even be surprising. So the sutta begins with mindfulness of breathing. And I'm not going to read the whole thing, but essentially it's very simple. It's just to be present for the breath, to be aware that we're breathing in and out, and just begin to know something about the breath that's coming in and out. So whether it's long or short, for example, or where we feel it in the body, feeling it through the whole body. So we can subsume awareness of the body into awareness of the breath, in a sense, in sitting meditation. So we are to feel the whole body as we breathe in and out. However, let me start with an even more basic body practice than that, which is that our informal moment-to-moment practice, you know, our daily life practice that's so critical to sustaining the continuity in our lives, that can focus on mindfulness of the body. Posture, muscle tension, you know, whether we're tight, and our breathing. Also, we can notice our breathing while we're standing in line, things like that. As we go through our day, we can try to remain grounded in the body as much as possible. Actually, I am going to read the section on the four postures So this is just the beginning part of it. When walking, a practitioner understands I am walking. When standing, he or she understands I am standing. When sitting, he or she understands I am sitting. When lying down, he or she understands I am lying down. Or he or she understands accordingly, however his or her body is disposed. It's so simple, right? Are you aware right now that you're sitting? Every one of us is sitting or lying. So it's just a natural way to be in the present moment, to be aware of the position that your body is in. And then there's a section even that goes into even more detail. For example, it says, a practitioner is one who acts in full awareness when going forward and returning, when looking ahead and looking away, when flexing and extending the limbs, when wearing robes, clothing for us, when eating, drinking, consuming food and tasting, when defecating and urinating, when walking, standing, sitting, falling asleep, waking up, talking, and keeping silent. That pretty much covers it, huh? So this is something that I know Andrea talks about in this group, is that it's really important just to be aware of what you're doing as you're doing it. And that is practice right there. You don't have to think, oh, I'm not doing anything complicated. I'm not, you know, abiding in some kind of amazing state of samadhi. But if you know that you're sitting while you're sitting, you're practicing. That's mindfulness. And that's forward leading. It brings the practice forward. So, for example, you can feel your hand as you reach for the light switch, or notice your spinal alignment as you're sitting in a chair. You know, am I balanced? If I'm not, I'm going to hurt 10 minutes from now. As you walk to your car, instead of thinking about where you're going to go, notice the breeze on your cheeks as you're walking towards the car. So I talk about this in some detail because I love it dearly. This is the kind of practice that I do when I'm not sitting. I've had for a long time a practice of relaxing. In particular, it's important for me to relax, open, and balance the body throughout the day. And it's something that's great. You can do it, no one knows you're doing it, so it's invisible and always available. I've noticed over time that I have a habitual tendency to tense up or to push against the contact points, sitting on a chair or standing, or if I'm have my hands on a table, I'll notice that there's a little bit of tension. I'm sort of like, you know, not fully in contact with what I'm in contact with. It's just a little bit of, you know, tension. And over time, I've gradually learned that when I remember, I just remind myself, oh, relax. Relax against whatever surface you're against. Not only does this decrease pain in the long run, but it's a great mindfulness check. And I can say that over time, over a long time, the gradual process of physical release, even when done in normal life situations outside of meditation, does lead to various releases in the heart also. So it's supportive of deeper work, even if it's occurring under normal consciousness. We can go farther than this with body-related awareness. We can do deliberate practices that bring mindfulness to the body. So yoga, for example, or qigong or tai chi, exercises that are designed to be deliberately physical. These encourage a deeper sense of balance in the body, and they also begin to touch the relationship between body and mind, which is a profound area of practice. You know, you'll begin to notice, oh, the reason I'm, you know, when I'm worried about what I'm going to do tomorrow, there's a particular spot in my back that I tense. Oh, you know, I didn't realize that before. And you'll notice the link between letting go of those thoughts and letting go of that tension in the body. And that is a really important place of practice, is to start to discern those things. It doesn't mean that every tension in your body is because of something in your mind or vice versa. But there's always a reflection in the body of what's going on in the mind. So that's something that we can explore for ourselves. And then, in meditation, of course, we can use the breath or the body or both as an object. This is usually the object most of us start with, is the breath, or sometimes some aspect of the body. And there are a number of modes of this type of practice. One is, so this is during sitting practice, one is to follow the same practice that I described above of noticing where the tension is and relaxing it. You can do that just fine in your sitting meditation also. So just sit there and notice, oh, there's a little tension in my knee. Can I relax that? Just invite it to relax. It's not necessarily that we are relaxing it. And if it doesn't relax, that's okay too. But just notice where it is and kind of intend for that. And the principle behind this practice is that as the body relaxes, the mind will follow. That's the idea. And I found it to be true overall. Another mode of breath and body practice in sitting is to let the breath and body sensations arise and pass within the space of mindfulness. So it's a similar kind of thing, but it's done kind of at a more broad level. You sit and be the awareness yourself and watch the sensations arise and pass. This is also described actually in the Satipatthana Sutta, where it says that one mode of practice is to abide contemplating the nature of the body to arise and vanish. And the same for the mind and other forms. Either of these methods that I mentioned stabilizes the mind and can lead toward deep states of calm and concentration as well as to deep insights. Focusing on the body also leads to joy, happiness, and equanimity in the mind. And within the breath and body, we can discover the three characteristics of existence, which are impermanence, unsatisfactoriness, and not-self. They're all present in the body, and understanding of those leads to freedom. So the next part of the Satipatthana Sutta talks about seeing the body as a collection of body parts and also as elements, as physical elements. So this is now starting to see the body as something not so personal. And that's kind of the aim. So I won't mention all the body parts that are listed here. There are 32 of them. Well, maybe I will. It's worth it. It starts with the five external body parts: head hairs, body hairs, nails, teeth, and skin. It's pretty much what we can see on somebody. And then it goes on to list the others, which are flesh, sinews, bones, bone marrow, kidneys, heart, liver, diaphragm, spleen, lungs, intestines, mesentery, contents of the stomach, feces, brain, bile, phlegm, pus, blood, sweat, fat, tears, grease, spittle, snot, oil of the joints, and urine. Not all those are our favorite things, perhaps. But it goes on to make it kind of impersonal. It says, just as though there were a bag with an opening at both ends full of many sorts of grain, such as hill rice, red rice, beans, peas, millet, and white rice, and a man with good eyes were to open it and review it thus, this is hill rice, this is red rice, these are beans, etc. So you review your body as being composed of these various parts. That's all it really is. And so you might say, all right, this is getting a little odd for me. It's a little kind of not part of how we usually see things. Is there even any access to really doing this meditation properly? And there is, which is that Bob Stahl, who is a teacher down in Santa Cruz, some of you may have heard of him. He's actually the main teacher now that Mary Grace Orr has retired from that group. He offers a detailed course of study around these 32 body parts. So if you're not intrigued, don't worry about it. But if you are intrigued, he offers a full course. It's some number of weeks. He teaches you how to practice in this way because maybe sounds a little disconnected just reading it from the sutta. I haven't done this course, but I know someone who has, and she said it was fascinating and profound, and that sort of, you know, it's a limited time. You just try it for however long the course is, and it really has some interesting effects. So if you're intrigued, I offer that. I haven't done that, but I did one time, just out of interest, I meditated on the 32 parts in a non-traditional way. I meditated on one part per day for 32 days, just to see what would happen. I kind of focused on it, you know, what is this? When I wasn't sitting, I thought about it, and, you know, kind of reflected on it. When I was sitting, I focused on where it was in my body. And I learned a lot, actually. What I learned, this is a pretty surface-level thing to just do it for 1 month, but I learned a lot about the connection between them. Things opened up where I saw which parts were related and how they were related. And that was just one per day. So, you know, you can do things like that. The next practice offered is the elements. So this is an interesting one, right? This says a person reviews their body, however it is placed, as consisting of elements thus. In this body there are the earth element, the water element, the fire element, and the air element. So there's, you know, this is the classical elemental view. We might say, yeah, well, we now have the periodic table and we know there's 121 elements or whatever we're up to now, you know. But this way of seeing the body is very intuitive. And so, for example, the earth element is the solidity and hardness of the body. So the parts that feel solid, we surely feel those because we're sitting against the cushion. The air element is the motion in the body. It's the movement of the breath through the body, the feeling that you have of energy moving in the body. That's considered the air element. The fire element is the heat or coolness in the body. So you may feel that when you're sitting, your belly is warm and your hands are a little bit cold. Well, that's fire element. So you can notice that. The water element's a little more subtle. It's the liquidity of the body. You can feel the wetness of your mouth, for example, or your eyes. And it's also the said to be the cohesion of the body. The liquid element is what binds the solid together. That may sound a little odd, but if you can think about it as like sand on the beach. You know, when you go to the beach, the sand is really dry and powdery, and it's not holding together at all. But as you get closer to the water line, it becomes solid when it's wet, right? Then you're walking on the sand and you're leaving footprints in it, and it's actually a solid thing. And then as you get all the way into the ocean, then you're back into liquid and there's there's nothing being held. But the liquid is what holds solid together into making it a solid. So it's interesting to see the body this way rather than automatically thinking of it in terms of abstract parts like my knee hurts or I'm cold. The elements can become the subject of, we can see whatever's arising in the body as one or the other of the elements instead of interpreting it in some other way, and that just retrains the mind from our usual way of seeing the body into this different way that's a little bit less personal. Another way to approach this practice is to take one of the elements as the subject of meditation. This is very interesting. I say this because this is one that I've done. I spent some, not in great detail, but I spent some time on one retreat I got interested where I would just focus only on the earth element in the body, for example. So you know how I'm giving an analogy. When you're looking for something, you know, I'm looking for a pen. I walk into a room and automatically your mind kind of attunes towards objects that are this size and shape, right? I'm holding up a pen. So, you know, you're not looking at the vase of flowers and you're not looking at the beanbag on the floor because you're looking for a pen. So your mind kind of attunes to things that are cylindrical and about that long. So in the same way, you can attune your mind to let's see anything in the body that's solid or hard. And the mind will kind of go that way and focus in on it. And so then you're focusing on the earth element as a subject of meditation. And then you can switch and you can say, okay, now I'm only going to feel the air element and feel all the motion in the body. And the mind will, it's like a lens, the mind will attune to that. And with a little bit of practice, not even very much, with a little bit of practice, you can get to the point where you can just switch between them. It's kind of fun. I encourage this if you think it's interesting. You know, then switch to fire, to water, back to earth. Can you do it? It doesn't have to be perfect. It's just, you know, just see what happens when you try thinking of your body that way. So next, the sutta moves into body practices that are more obscure to us. These are the, they're listed as the 9 charnel ground meditations. They're ways, we still have access to these, and so I want to talk about that a little bit. These practices are basically about exposing the mind to the fact that the body will die. And, you know, it's something that we all know. You know, no one here is going to say they don't know that. But generally, we ignore it, avoid it, or deny it in some way. And it's something that we let in the way that we can and to the degree that we can as we go along in practice. So, I'm just going to talk about it briefly and in a way that I found it meaningful. And if you're not interested, that's fine. And if you are interested, I'm going to present this as a model because I want to point out that even lay people practicing in the West can access these deeper meditations that are mentioned here. The charnel ground meditations, I'm not going to read all of them, but they basically talk about you think about a dead body and then the various ways that it decomposes as falling apart, the flesh falling off of it, just the bones left. And so you can say, well, you know, we don't really have access to that here, and it doesn't make, you know, I'm sure monks did that in ancient India when people left bodies lying around. But what does that mean for me in my life, and how can I work with these deeper things that the Buddha encourages us to look at, but in a way that works for me? So I'm just going to mention a few, because they really are, these are accessible to us. For example, we can volunteer at a hospital or a hospice. It's a totally safe setting. You're going to be supported among other volunteers. There's well-established volunteer programs, but through that, you will encounter people who are very sick or within days or weeks of dying. And a lot of people work in these professions and don't think about their own death when they're there. It's totally amazing. But you could take it on as a spiritual practice if you wanted to. And through your own intention, through your own interest, it becomes a way of doing these body practices that are mentioned in the Satipatthana Sutta. You can take it on in that way. One way to do it, for example, is to, if you relate it to the body, is to consciously observe their bodies. Really look. Have you really looked at someone who's very sick? And then reflect that into you. That could be me someday. Just that one little thought. You don't have to go into, you know, long, complicated contemplations about that. Just the simple thought of, that could be me someday. That's enough to start your heart opening a little bit. It's a great place to start. Another thing that we can do that's also relatively accessible, if you're intrigued by this kind of practice, is you can sit in a graveyard. Why not? There are graveyards around here. They're very safe places. You can go there. You don't even have to meditate. You can walk among the gravestones and read them and think, okay, someday one of those is going to be for me. And just notice what that evokes in you. Or you can literally find a spot. Most of them have benches. You can sit down. And I recommend if you do this that you make your mind very open and kind of encompass the space that you're sitting in with your mind, like you would if you were sitting out in a beautiful nature setting, but you're sitting in a cemetery. And so just see what that brings up for you. It's really quite doable. I've actually done this, and it's interesting. You know, it's interesting. This is deep Dharma practice, and it's all based on our intention and our interest. If it's something that you want to try, it's really doable. Now, with some deliberate effort, we can even find practices that are quite intense and go even deeper into this. I have always had an interest in body practice and in death-related practice, and so maybe that's why this opportunity came to me. I don't know. But I heard about, somehow, a workshop that was offered for people like you and me, just regular old people, in human dissection. I read this thing and I thought, oh my gosh, really? And usually just medical students get to do things like that. But it was offered a few years ago, and I thought, you know, I'm really gonna do it. So I did, and it was a 6-day course. Don't worry, there's not a lot of gory details. But I want to share it because I really want to point out that these kinds of deeper practices are available to us, even here in the West, even as lay people. So maybe we'll say that there's like a rating on this talk, like for movies, and it's rated HM for Heavenly Messenger. And again, it's all in the attitude. You know, I took on this dissection workshop as a spiritual practice. I wanted to see what that would be like. So I actually wrote about my experience. I wrote some reflections that were published in a book about lay practitioners sharing their Dharma wisdom. That was published here through IMC, called Passing It On. It's available online in PDF form, so it's on IMC's website. But I have a hard copy here that I'm going to read from. And it's... I just want to read this as a... This is something I wrote afterwards as a reflection, as a way of pointing out what this experience meant to me and how it became a spiritual practice for me. You know, kind of what it opened up. So as a little bit of background, the workshop was mainly for body workers, it turns out. A lot of people there were like chiropractors, or they did some kind of integral holistic medicine kind of thing, but they didn't, you know, because they hadn't gone through medical school, they hadn't done the cadaver dissection, and they were just thrilled to be able to see the parts that they were working on. It's like, wow, this is really enhancing my practice. For me, it was enhancing practice too, but it was spiritual practice. So it was actually led by a fellow who was himself a body practitioner, but before that, his life had been as a Catholic theologian, so he had kind of the spiritual dimension too. And in the little description of the course, it said, by unwrapping the layers of the donor's gift, participants uncover hidden layers of themselves. It's true. And we approached the body as layers. It was fascinating. So we sort of took off one layer per day. You'll see as I read through. So first the skin, and then the fat, and then the muscles. And this is a very different way than a medical student would approach the body, by the way. They tend to do regional anatomy. You know, they go in and they look at the heart or whatever. And it's just that. You don't ever see the body as a holistic, integrated thing. And so being able to treat it that way was, I felt, very respectful, very spiritual, and was the avenue for which all this other stuff could open up, much more than if we just treated it like a part that we were cutting into. So I actually treated the course as a retreat, and that turned out to be a very apt analogy. So day one, arriving. 30 people came together to share a task quite different from daily life. We began by standing in a circle and appreciating the gifts of the donors, silently beholding the four forms that would teach us that week. We set up an offering table on which we could place objects of inspiration throughout the course. Our guide seated it with a seashell. Rather than opening to the enormity of the whole undertaking, I focused my effort simply on being there and fully arriving. I attended carefully to the initial instructions on how to use a scalpel. Addressing the skin layer first, we removed the mask shown to the outer world. Day two, the slog. Here we encountered the oft-avoided adipose or fat layer, and we had no choice but to go through it. Our experienced guide helped us understand that due to superficial societal mores, the adipose is misperceived. It is, in fact, a whole organ unto itself and rarely appreciated or fully open to. The emotional current in the room ran high, bringing feelings of repulsion, overstimulation, pain, compassion, and the associated story-making. I found myself wondering if I could really undertake the tasks of the whole week. Later, at home, I took a long hot shower and had an unsettled sitting. The next day, one woman reported crying in her hotel room for no discernible reason, while another spoke hotly of her complaints about the workshop. Many flowers appeared on the offering table. Day 3, energy. The deep fascia and muscle layers brought surprising buoyancy. Spontaneous peals of laughter erupted across the room at one point, and our forms took on a sporty, well-toned look. At last, there was a feeling of settling into our unusual activity. On a lark, I picked up a partially opened pine cone for the offering table and saw that others had added candles and feathers. And yet, I had an intuitive sense that this happy reprieve was temporary, serving mostly to gird us for the deeper work to come. We received instruction on using hemostats and tweezers to probe the tissues more delicately. It was becoming clear that the layers of the body, while clearly distinct, were nonetheless created by the tools. Nothing in the body is truly separate. The tissues literally interpenetrate and are everywhere infused with nerves and vessels. In sitting that evening, my mind was a little too quiet, as if concealing part of itself. Days 4 and 5, deep spelunking. Here we penetrated to the heart of the body, revealing the organs that sustain life and cause death. Each form had its own oddities of which the person was likely unaware. For example, a large intestine barely wider than the small intestine, and an extra muscle unaccounted for in medical texts. We also witnessed the features accumulated through life experience: artificial heart valves, a stent in the abdominal aorta, and a pill cam that had not completed its tortuous trek through the gut. Although the excitement of discovery evoked fountains of energy in me, I also connected with a stillness deep in my being, punctuated by awe. I was unprepared for the emotional impact of holding a human heart, which in turn holds the universe. For the offering table, I drew a mandala using colored pencils, my intention at each moment simply to pick up the next color that felt right and draw the next shape that occurred. It came out swirly and interconnected, pink, coral, ochre, and fuchsia, with a streak of leaf green. These are the colors of the body. The warm tone persists even in the chill of death. In sitting that evening, I sat like the ocean, immovable and ever-flowing. Day 6, emptiness and letting go. On the last day, we sought the innermost spaces, penetrating the brain, spinal cord, and bone marrow. My own nerves tingled eerily as I slipped the cord out of the fortress of the spinal column so that it dangled freely from the primitive hindbrain like a ponytail. We were at the core, but it was impossible to ignore the fact that we did not find the person, and no part was more important than another. There is nothing in the body but relationships. Untangle these and the form is empty. Finally, with a simple and profound gratitude, we let the forms go. After holding hands in a hushed circle, we packed them in plain brown boxes to ship to the crematory and back to their families. Upon hearing that we were allowed to add objects from the offering table, I gently placed the mandala over the tender heart that had inspired it. Our group's 30 lives went on, but surely each had a shift in its course. The outside looks different after seeing the inside, although the resemblance between the two also increases. So even though it's been a few years since I did that, I find that that experience has shaped my understanding of the body in certain ways that are still relevant. So this kind of practice is long-lasting, shall we say. And probably the most important thing is that the deeper we go into the body, the deeper we go into the mind. So I'm saying that exploration of the body at a deep level, whether it's external, physically, like what I did, or you can do this in meditation. You know, you can sit and really go as far as you can into your body. It's available right there for you. Very safe. It's a really interesting journey. So I encourage you not to stop at the surface level of your body and not to stop at the my knee hurts level of your body, but really look deeper. See if you can get down to a cellular level, something very intimate with your own body, because it really goes far. In particular, working with the body classically in the suttas is often said to reduce desire, because we see that the body is really just this collection of parts. It's just, it's not as beautiful as we think it is on the outside. It's, you know, it's got these parts that aren't as appealing. I would point, though, from my, and I don't doubt that, but my experience with the body is that it points toward the experience of anatta, of not self. So that the farther we go into this body, you know, we only have this one to look at, internally at least, is to discover that it's not controllable, it's not ours, it's not. Anatta is entirely experience of not. The body is not the self. And it's very, maybe initially disconcerting to realize that we're carrying this collection of elements around that we don't really own. But also freeing. You know, we're, in a way, the body is an alien or foreign thing, a collection of non-living elements that have coalesced out of the surroundings like a seashell. You know, why did the instructor put a seashell? Why did he talk about that? Well, how did the body form? You know, it coalesced out of the surroundings somehow by some deep natural forces that know to make the body into this configuration. This is why we don't know what our body is. We weren't there when it formed. We're not controlling how it evolves. It's not us, but it's there for us to learn about. The deeper we go into the body, the deeper we go into the mind. So I have great respect for the body. It is indeed a vehicle. It's a vehicle of skillful action in the world. It's a vehicle of insight, and it's potentially a vehicle of liberation. So we have a profound opportunity to understand our body while we have it in this lifetime. Please avail yourself of this opportunity. Thank you.